Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind.
And I'm Grace Wan. This is your weekly conversation about where we live.
And what matters most. We are live.
And we are local.
Every Monday night.
Right here on KALW, San Francisco, Bay Area. Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. My co-host Ethan Elkind is off for the night, but you'll hear from him later on in the show talking to Bay Area violinist Raginder about mixing Indian classical music, hip-hop, and R&B into his own unique sound. We'll also be talking about tipping. It turns out that compared to the rest of the country, here in San Francisco, we're not as great tippers as we would have thought. If you're in the service industry, maybe you already knew that. But we'll get into why we tip, how we tip, and whether you, our listeners, have been noticing tip creep. But first, the closure of Silicon Valley Bank last week sent shockwaves through the Bay Area and the larger banking industry, and concerns have spread to First Republic Bank, which is also based here. While the FDIC has stepped in to protect depositors at Silicon Valley Bank, its parent company has gone into bankruptcy. And for First Republic, its fate remains in the balance as a $30 billion cash infusion and efforts to sell a chunk of the bank have not calmed investors. Here to help us understand where things stand, we're joined by Kevin Truong, who covers small business policy and economic recovery at the San Francisco Standard. Welcome back to State of the Bay, Kevin.
Thank you for having me, Grace.
Well, we're psyched that you're here. Listen, it's been a tough time for regional banks, and let's start with the fallout from Silicon Valley Bank. The FDIC has stepped in to guarantee the depositors. They're being made whole. But let's talk about some of the bank's business. It was the financing bank of choice for startups, and it held mortgages, personal loans, and lines of credit. What's going to happen with all those financial instruments?
So what the regulators have done is sort of set up a successor bank to kind of take on a lot of the assets and liabilities and banking activities of the former Silicon Valley Bank. So the hope is that a lot of that activity may continue, but it all is reliant on folks coming back to the bank, putting deposits back in the bank, you know, seeking loan originations with the bank, mortgages and other stuff like that. And you know, there's a lot of confidence that needs to be built back up after, you know, some of the actions and events of the last couple of weeks. So it's still an open question on whether they will still be able to kind of grow the business and create kind of an independent business line outside of, you know, some of the remainders of what they had.
You know, I saw someone on TV last week who is a depositor at the bank saying, well, I think I'm going to stay. It seems like the safest place in America to have your money since the FDIC has backed it up. Have you seen similar reactions?
Yeah, there's definitely a kind of a rubber band effect from folks who are saying, okay, well, the federal government has declared this a systematic part of the financial system, basically providing an insurance in a way. And we're seeing folks from the tech industry, which were a big clientele of the bank, saying, all right, this is the bank that kind of supported us for 40 years. This is the bank that kind of knows our business better than pretty much anyone else in the industry. And maybe we weren't getting the level of customer service or terms in some of the bigger banks. So maybe we should be coming, you know, sort of standing strong and providing a little bit more confidence in Silicon Valley.
Well, will the employees of SVB stay there? I mean, what happens to them?
So the employment of those workers have shifted over to the Silicon Valley bank successor. Mm-hmm. But it's still an open question on, you know, what would happen. You know, I talked to one employee last week who basically said, you know, with the smaller book of business that the bank has, we don't need the headcount to support, you know, the 8,000 or so employees that Silicon Valley Bank used to employ. So there's some concerns that that may lead to layoffs or job cuts of some kind for that portion of the employees.
I mean, it's such a tough story on so many levels. You know, without Silicon Valley Bank in the picture, how do you think that's going to affect the local economy, both in San Francisco and just the larger Bay Area? Because it was a startup bank, but that's not its only line of business.
No, you know, they were a major funder of affordable housing, which, you know, is obviously very, very difficult to finance even in the best of environments. So now you have some affordable housing developers where a Silicon Valley Bank mortgage or a loan was a major part of their financing. of projects sort of stuck in a little bit of a limbo, trying to find alternative financing or figuring out whether some of these obligations they had from the banks still are standing. And that's going to lead to a little bit of a slowdown in affordable housing production in a region that sorely needs it.
I mean, just what we need to hear, that like less affordable housing being built. And are developers scrambling? Are they looking for new lines of financing?
Yeah, and I think there's actually a affordable housing developer going to the Board of Supervisors tomorrow to kind of discuss the issue and talk a little bit about their issues with financing and whether they've been able to find an alternative provider to Silicon Valley Bank or whether they feel like they can kind of continue on with their project. Mm-hmm.
You had a recent piece out, I think today, about the shareholders in the bank. That's different from the depositors. These are people who held stock in the bank. And I'm just curious, who took some big hits?
Yeah, so a lot of the people that took the big hits were those that were invested in the bank outside of putting their money in the bank as a client or deposit. So there are folks like, the executives, which many of which had, if we take maybe 2 years, 2 weeks ago as a bit of a marker, millions of dollars of stock options and ownerships in the bank. And then there are the big sort of financial players that were the major owners of the bank. You have retirement funds, 401k providers, pension funds that were invested in the bank as part of their, portfolio. Mm-hmm. And those people will be taking a hit as well.
You know, one thing that has come up in the last few days about this particular bank is the fact that their risk officer, well, they didn't have a risk officer. And that fact wasn't well known to the public and maybe even to their board. Is that typical? And how is that fact shaking out?
Yeah, there's still a little bit of questions on why they went without a risk officer for so long. And it was clearly now in hindsight, something that they needed. I think from April to last December, a period of, 7+ months, they didn't have a risk officer. And that was happening at the same time as regulators and the Federal Reserve were sending letters of warning to the bank saying, we see signs of distress in your portfolio. What are ways that you're trying to head off some of these risks? I think that their last message came in early March, which at that time was a little too little too late.
Well, President Biden offered no sympathy for shareholders or indications that they would be made whole. What is it that Biden said exactly?
Basically said that, we are, as the federal government, are going to backstop depositors who were just clients of the bank and had no role in its collapse. But we're not going to be bailing out any investors or executives. And he basically said, well, that's capitalism, baby.
I mean, live or die, right? Live or die. Well, the other big story today in banking news, and I feel like we're all becoming bank reporters now these days. That news is First Republic Bank, and that's a bank that was founded in San Francisco, at one time was owned by Merrill Lynch, and now is privately held. I spoke to some industry experts last week who said that with the failure of SVB, First Republic might be the bank of choice for former depositors. Would you say that's still the case?
I would say that has not been the case. Just as a kind of a scene setter, First Republic received a big tranche of funding from J.P. Morgan and some of the other too big to fail banks last week, $30 billion. And that was meant to sort of stem the depositor outflow. Basically, a lot of the bank's clientele saying, OK, we see elements of risk, we see elements of distress, and we want to pull our money out. And that worked for a time. The bank's share price stabilized. But today, the bank stock fell by more than 45%, and it hit all-time lows. So that depositor outflow is continuing. And I think the Wall Street Journal reported that in the last couple of weeks, the customers have pulled some $70 billion of deposits.
Yikes.
And that's something like 40% of the bank's total.
You know, you use that term too big to fail. And, with the FDIC backstopping a Silicon Valley Bank, which was a $20 billion bank. I mean, it almost feels like it's too medium sized to fail as well. I mean, do you think the FDIC is going to have to step in for First Republic? Is it is it talking about that?
Yeah, well, I read some reporting that the Biden administration has been calling Warren Buffett, who famously helped to bail out Goldman Sachs during the Great Financial Crisis. So I think, and Jamie Dimon, who's the CEO of J.P. Morgan, is reportedly going to be meeting with other bank executives tomorrow to try to figure out whether there's a rescue plan that can be put into effect. Because I think everyone realizes that even though this might be a too small to bail bank,
yes.
in some cases, they realize that a failure of First Republic, which I think is the 14th largest bank in the country, is no good in sort of shoring up confidence in the banking sector as a whole.
Yeah. And what are the similarities in the banks in terms of causation? Were they both caught flat footed because of rising interest rates?
That was part of it. Yeah. They both held these essentially short term bonds in their portfolio that were devalued with large interest rate hikes that we've seen over the past year or two. But also, you got to think about their clientele. Silicon Valley Bank, a major portion of their clientele were, you know, venture capitalists, startups, things like that. In First Republic, a major portion of their clientele are sort of high net worth individuals. They specialize in wealth management. These are folks who are attuned to the market, who are probably watching CNBC or Bloomberg, and who are basically saying, okay, if I see signs of risk, I have other banking relationships in which to pull our money. So, you know, you're seeing depositor outflow out of banks like First Republic, but you're seeing big inflows to banks like J.P. Morgan, who are the kind of too big to fail beneficiaries of this sort of volatility we're seeing.
Yeah, so those might be the winners in this moment.
Yeah, yeah. But you can tell from their efforts to be part of this rescue plan that they see a collapse of a bank like First Republic is more harmful than maybe some of the short-term benefits that they're getting.
Right. Well, I mean, it's time to, like, corral the wagons, circle the wagons, you know, for everyone. So do you have any sense that depositors – you mean just said that some depositors are trying to spread their assets among banks. I mean, for most Americans, an FDIC guarantee of up to $250,000 in deposits might be more than enough. But in spreading their savings or their assets to different banks, is that just trying to spread risk?
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, a lot of big companies, even medium-sized companies, have that as part of their risk management strategy, having a few relationships with banks so they spread out that risk. And I was talking to a venture capitalist last week who's basically saying, you know, with his conversations with startups, that's going to be a part of their best practices advice going forward, you know, particularly with the events in the last couple of weeks.
Right. Well, I mean, I think one of the issues that startups face, of course, is that they're looking for financing. And often a bank will say, well, if I'm going to give you a line of credit, you must bring all your banking to my bank, you know. And I guess people will push back harder on that term.
Yeah. And I think that was one of the sort of catch-22s that some clients of Silicon Valley Bank were caught up in, where, you know, this was the only bank, particularly because Silicon Valley Bank specialized in startups. This is the only bank that was going to underwrite these high risk early stage companies. At the same time, they were making it a prerequisite to put all their money in the bank itself. So they were kind of caught in this situation, which was difficult.
Well, you know, the federal government has done a lot to try to calm the markets. Janet Yellen, President Biden, they've all come out repeatedly to say that the banking system in the United States is both stable and safe. But, you know, this did get frothed up by Twitter and people starting to say, like, oh, so-and-so is taking their money out of this bank. And that started sort of a bank run, as it were. Are people feeling calmer now? And should they feel calm?
Well, you know, I can't comment on the conversation on Twitter. I think we all maybe spent a little bit too much time there. I think what we've seen is maybe the first modern digital bank run, which some of the forces that led to the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank were exacerbated and accelerated by the sort of social media environment that we live in today, where somebody can tweet something and it goes out to a million people in the blink of an eye. Whereas, you know, in the It's a Wonderful Life scenario of a bank run, you had to actually line up So there's a little bit of a difference there.
I mean, I've seen that clip a bunch of times now. It's like you have to be sitting in a taxi cab on your way to your honeymoon, watching people line up in front of your bank. I think that's the It's a Wonderful Life version. You know, and in 2008, I don't think Twitter was around. But I mean, in the 2008 financial crisis, I think it was blogs that frothed people up. But that is of a different time in and of itself. And probably the fact that you could swipe left and change your deposits, too, right, must have played a role. So First Republic and Silicon Valley Bank were not just major players in the economy of the city. They're also responsible for a great deal of philanthropy here as well. And do you have any sense of how this is impacting nonprofits or people who rely on that generosity and goodwill?
I haven't seen the direct impact on philanthropy or sponsorships at First Republic in particular. Silicon Valley Bank has definitely pulled back on some of that activity.
Yes.
And some of their former executives now sat on the boards of some of these large nonprofits, and they no longer do. There's distress in some big company like this. One of the first things to get cut are the philanthropy, the support to nonprofits, the support to social services. And, you know, as like you said, First Republic has been a major part of the community in that sense. So any distress or any failure in that sense is sort of harmful to that broader mission.
Well, before I let you go, Kevin, I want to ask, what story are you looking at next? What are you looking out for on the horizon?
In regards to the banking industry, I am interested in one of the first questions you asked is what happens to these employees?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, that's thousands and thousands of people who, mm-hmm. Through no fault of their own, are working at institutions that are under stress or in some cases underwater. Another couple of things that I'm looking for are the interest rate hikes. Whether, you know, there's been some conversation that with some of the volatility in the banking system, people are going to be pulling back, loans are going to be pulling back, and that's actually going to have a bit of a deflationary impact. And what maybe that will induce the Fed to actually lower interest rates at a slower pace. And also, I'm going to be looking at the rise of some of these neobanks, places like Mercury and Brex.
Yeah.
That have emerged and have kind of positioned themselves as not your, you know, grandfather's bank. And still an open question on whether they will be the banks of tomorrow. But it's an interesting and emerging space.
Well, I hope that when you get your reporting out there, you'll come back here on State of the Bay to talk about it.
Would love to be here.
Well, we'll always be happy to have you. Thank you for joining us. That was Kevin Truong. He's a reporter covering small business policy and economic recovery at the San Francisco Standard. Have a good night, Kevin.
Thank you.
Coming up next on State of the Bay, we're talking about tipping, increased expectations around it, and what is fair for consumers and for service workers. That's right after the break. Stay with us. Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. San Francisco and its citizens have a lot to be proud of, but apparently we are kind of lousy tippers. According to a 2022 restaurant survey, we pay 17% on average. That is 2% less than the national tipping average, which is 19%. It seems that these days tipping is not limited to restaurants or your hair salon. Tipping seems to have become part of so many other parts of our transactional lives. Have you noticed that more and more places are asking you for a tip? We're going to dig into what's happening with tipping. Joining me to discuss the issues are Jesse Antilla Hughes, an economics professor at University of San Francisco. Welcome to State of the Bay, Jesse.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Oh, we're excited to have you here. We're also joined by Sarah Holtz. She's the food and culture writer for the San Francisco Standard. Welcome to State of the Bay, Sarah.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, and listeners, we want to hear from you. I am sure there are a lot of opinions out there about tipping. I mean, what do you think constitutes a good tip? Are you a service worker who depends on tips or a business owner whose employees are tipped? Share your thoughts by calling us toll-free here at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-TALK. Or by emailing us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. So, Jesse, I wanted to start with you. You're an economics professor, and you're probably very familiar with tipping in our service industries. Can you just start off by giving our listeners just your definition of tipping and why you think customers tip?
So tipping's a complex one with an interesting history. And, you know, one of the things that's always good to keep in mind about it is that it's pretty uniquely American in the historical view. You know, like when Europeans, for example, come to the States, they're routinely caught off guard. and just about few other places have tipping as embedded. And so where exactly it comes from is historically complex. But what tipping is paying an additional bit of money at the end of some kind of a service, typically with some kind of understanding of some kind of reciprocal tit-for-tat quality, you know, basically paying a bit more than is currently on the bill. The thing that's interesting about tipping is that in the United States, it's what economists and, you know, most other social scientists would call a norm, as in it's an expected thing to be done. It's not something that's legally done, right? It's rather enforced through communitarian and cultural forms. So often an econ will think there's markets, states, communities as different ways that we organize things like economic production. Tipping is very much a community cultural norm type thing.
Right.
And that's why I think it's an interesting thing to study, because it's a core part of how economies work, right? But it's also definitely one of these loosey-goosey sort of things, like what is the right level to tip?
Yeah. Oh, what do you think is the right level to tip,
Jesse? That's a great question. So I'm from the Bronx in New York City, and my dad was a bartender when I was growing up. And what's, you know, I was taught that the classic social norm was a 15% solid tip. And then, you know, more than that, if it was good service, by all means, you know, go crazy if you think that the person was fantastic. And so, you know, this would be the kind of the standard thing. Of course, this was also set when he was a bartender in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, when the minimum wage was a lot higher in relative terms,
right?
And a variety of other things where it plays also in New York City at high end places, which tip well. And so this is, I think, one of the things that's in the background of tipping is, you know, whether 15% is right or it should be 18% or 20 is really, at the end of the day, this mixed cultural and moral question that interacts with things like income inequality, how much someone should get paid for doing a good job at any kind of job, etc.
I mean, I'm a parent. I feel like my kids should be tipping me often and regularly. Sarah, what do you think about this? You cover food and culture for the San Francisco Standard. I mean, do you think it's customary? It's a norm? I mean, if you didn't leave a tip, would you be shamed?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think that tipping is kind of central to this social contract of dining out. I think dining out and accessing services like that is a privilege. And so the sense that I've gotten from my reporting, which is mostly anecdotal and based on opinion, less on statistics, is that it's part of the social contract to tip. And here in the Bay Area, especially, you tip often, you tip well, you take into account things like income inequality. Because it's so vast here in the Bay.
Well, at the top of the show, I noted that San Franciscans tip less than the national average, which I was so surprised at, because I think of our culture as somewhat generous, and, you know, I was surprised. Let's just put it at that. What do you account for that? Why do you think we're below the average?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. And that study, the 17%, that was based on data from a point of sale platform called Toast. So just as a caveat, that collection of data was from one POS system, not like huge national averages. But I mean, as far as I know from my reporting, there's this sense that the cost of food in the Bay Area is so very high. And there's quite a bit of sticker shock when you go out and pay for anything here. So that could account for the fact that San Franciscans are tipping around 17% compared to the national average of 19%. And in cities like New York, it seems that those tipping averages are around 19 or 20%. But I mean, honestly, based on my reporting, it's still that, you know, folks who work in the tech sectors and the financial sectors have a sense that there is vast income inequality between where they work and the service industry. So there is this sense of collective responsibility to tip well.
Yeah, they feel that they should and they have to. It's a moral obligation to tip well. Well, there is something about the technology that's come up in tipping where, you know, I'll stand at the coffee counter and the console, like the toast console that you're talking about, turns around and there's those boxes to tip. And I feel like, ooh, talk about social norms. I feel like everyone is looking. I mean, I want to tip well anyway, but I certainly would not say no tip because I think I would be booed out of the coffee house. I mean, what do you think about that, Jesse?
So that's an interesting one, right? I think that a bunch of what's been going on with that creep in the increase in tipping is tied into big, deep other things going on in society.
Ooh.
So why is that norm going up? I think partly because the cost of living has been going up a lot, and particularly in places where nice restaurants are, coastal cities like New York and San Francisco. Places like San Francisco, the rents are now so out of control that you can't live as a bartender in this town. You certainly can't live as a bartender with a kid or two in this town like, you know, a generation back my dad could in New York. And so I think there's partly this really key set of failures that's happening in American policy at a federal level related to things like getting the minimum wage up higher and also at local regional levels, right? Like California is in the middle of a decades plus long horrible housing crisis, which means that basic things like getting someone to come in at 4 a.m. to set up shop requires having someone who can get to the place with a car, not on the BART, and then can't be living too far, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so that tightens these labor markets and pay is not necessarily going up, and we super regulate these things in San Francisco. So all of this ends up when you walk up to that front desk, there's the norm is getting pushed up a little bit higher, maybe 20, maybe 25%. And then this gets even more complex with a bunch of the tech firms because a bunch of them will then not be honest about their tipping, right? DoorDash has gotten a bunch of trouble. A bunch of other similar types of companies have gotten issues with this where they've basically been taking a bunch of the tip residual for the firm, right? And so there's a variety of these weird sort of just like, let me see if I can get people to pay for it type things that happen with these sorts of digital platforms. And so these kinds of choice affordances, classic thing that people would say over in behavioral econ would be the kind of thing that direct us and can be potentially quite malicious.
When you hear that, when I hear that, I think, you know, I'm giving a tip because I know there's income inequality. I know I did receive really great service and I can afford to pay a dollar more for my coffee. It doesn't bother me. And then when I hear that the business is taking it and it's just the person who is supposed to get that fee isn't getting it, that's just, I feel like I'm being taken advantage of. Would you agree with that, Sarah? I mean, in the sense of it, when the tip doesn't go to the server, it feels like the person who's paying it, it might be, you know, their goodwill is being taken advantage of.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And it's kind of like what Jesse said, that, you know, tipping and the ubiquity of these iPad tablet kiosk platforms, it makes it seem like it's even easier than ever to tip. And it's putting the onus on diners to provide those wages. And you'd hope that they're going directly to the workers, but that's exactly right. I mean, often it's the company that benefits and it's the company that isn't providing the livable wages to begin with.
Well, Jesse mentioned this term tip creep, and we've talked about tip creeping. I mean, what is it's entered our vernacular now. And what do you think about that term? Is it a positive thing? Is it a negative thing, Sarah?
It seems like a positive thing from the outset, this idea of tipflation or tip creep, that we're being asked to tip for things that we maybe haven't ever been asked to tip for before. And I think it's, you know, it's this proliferation of these very easy, efficient tablet technologies where it's just you can tip with a press of a finger. But I think it's also that you know, we're putting the onus on diners, and there's this sense that we can make up for these deeper economic issues facing us by our individual actions, that if we just have the right idea and the right moral initiative to tip properly, then we can fix the issues facing our economy, fix these housing crisis issues. But I think maybe that's why the whole tipflation thing has such negative connotations, because, I mean, it simply doesn't work.
Right. It's hard to fix the economy one coffee at a time, one coffee tip at a time. Let me reintroduce the program. This is State at the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW. I'm Grace Wan. We're discussing tipping with Sarah Holtz. She's the food and culture writer for the San Francisco Standard. And Jesse Antilla Hughes. He's an economics professor at the University of San Francisco. What do you think, listeners, what do you think constitutes a good tip? And are you a service worker who depends on tips? And what do you think about the tipping that you're getting? Would you prefer a flat fee? You can join us by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Or find us on Twitter. We're at State of Bay. And speaking of tipping, we are also in pledge mode here at KALW. If you listen to the station and have never become a member, please consider joining KALW right now. You decide the amount you want to give at any level. You make a difference and are changing your relationship to this resource that you value. And I will say, I am in the studio and I'm looking at some incredibly awesome t-shirts. There is a KALW t-shirt. You know that we do the lunch menu here on KALW, and there is a fantastic lunch cafeteria tray t-shirt that you can get if you donate. Just need to call 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-KALW-917, or go to our website, kalw.org, and click donate. But now, back to tipping. So we were talking about just how you can solve the economy one tip at a time. You can't really do that. And so, Jesse, I wanted to try to understand how tipping can help at all. I mean, it is helpful, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a variety of ways of thinking about this, you know, over in, you know, game theory and industrialization parts of econ where we think about this. A big way that we'd approach this is that the norm of tipping means that I have this sort of implicit, incomplete little contract with the meal where if one or the other of us acts like a jerk, you know, if I'm really rude to the waiter or if the waiter spills my soup and then doesn't apologize, there is a mechanism at the end, which is this kind of additional thing that's supposed to be hanging out. And so part of this is that we regulate it with things like, you know, shaming someone. You know, if someone doesn't pay a tip, then potentially the wait staff will confront them and say, don't come back, you know, and really embarrass you in public.
Yeah.
And then on the flip side, you know, if I am, you know, really slacking at my job, then, you know, I don't get paid as well. But the problem, of course, is from a moral point of view, why is it the case that bartenders and cabbies and a variety of other people should have their wages contingent on those kinds of service experiences?
Right.
I think that's always what kind of gets people.
Yeah.
It then makes this sort of specific power asymmetry that a lot of people really think can be sort of particularly pernicious. You know, in Europe and places like this, this will be more like a career. You can go and be a waiter at a high-end place and people like, that's a real great job. And in the U.S., there's a lot of people that will still talk down on that in ways that, you know, I find quite distasteful, but that's just part of what it means when you can decide how much money someone gets paid.
Well, it's not like I've tipped my doctor or my dentist, you know, and that's an important service.
Yeah.
Well, we have a question from a listener, from Carol. She writes, sometimes I'm ordering on a tablet, not even from a person, and I am still prompted to tip, and the default percentages are still very high. I clear my own table, and I'm confused that I'm supposed to tip in that situation, too. What do you think about that, Sarah? There's more self-service restaurants and self-service experiences out there, especially after COVID, and people are still being asked for tips. If there's no real service, no one's being served, per se, should a tip be involved?
Yeah, I think it's sort of what you were describing before, where it's so murky because that tip could very well be going to the back of the house staff who wouldn't necessarily be getting tips otherwise and maybe aren't making a livable wage. But as we talked about before, oftentimes with those tablet systems, the tips end up going back to the company and not to the workers at all. And so it's really hard to say, but yeah, often that's not a great way to organize tipping, especially not at a fast casual restaurant or a restaurant where the customer doesn't feel as though they're getting that full service experience.
Yeah, so what should they do?
You know, I'm not sure. I always err on the side of tipping, but I don't know if that's right anymore. You know, I would rather know that there's a chance that the tip is going to the worker than it's than they're not getting anything.
Well, here in San Francisco, we have one of the highest minimum wages in the country. I think it's $16.99 an hour. And that includes people who receive tips and people who don't receive tips. And in your opinion, Jesse, does our higher minimum wage help workers in the service industry or hurt them?
I would say, you know, this is a complex question to ask. Like, what does the minimum wage actually do? I'd say from what we've seen at this point, the general consensus amongst most economists is that especially at this point in history, the minimum wage is not very helpful. And so in a place like San Francisco, I mean, if we were at the federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour, people would be, you know, it's bad enough as it is. Mm-hmm. And as it is, you can't earn a basic living in this city working a working class job.
Yeah.
And haven't been able to for quite a long time.
Right.
And so I'd say it's somewhat helpful, but I think kind of getting back to what you guys were talking about before with you can't, you know, get people to make policy happen out of the goodness of their own hearts. Mm. You can't just have people voluntarily pay people what they're supposed to get paid. Like, this is mm-hmm. why we have things like sectoral bargaining and actual meaningful policy to try to do things mm-hmm. like set living wages and also do things like simple common sense things like expand housing stock. Like, California mm-hmm. and New York now, my hometown, used to be a place with a lot of cheap housing. And yeah. through several decades of not getting stuff built, you know, you now have people in New York City trying to act like putting apartment buildings up in Manhattan is
yeah.
gentrification when you're right. like, this is just building more homes so that you can have a bartender who lives next door to the bar.
Well, let's talk about it from the perspective of the consumer for a second, because there is, you know, we've mentioned the term tipflation. There is this idea that, you know, it's hard to live in the city. I'm going out to get something to eat, and now I'm expected to give 25%, maybe even 30% in a tip that, you know, and some people say, well, then don't go out to eat. But, you know, people want to live. And so on that idea of tipflation, Sarah, where do you stand on that?
Right. Yeah. I think, again, it's that idea that we can't change policy and we can't change economics based on individual action. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I don't think by pressing like the eject button, so to speak, by not going out to eat at restaurants or, you know, by getting rid of restaurants entirely, I don't think we're going to solve the issue.
Yeah.
But I think if there's any way that restaurants can be more transparent mm-hmm. about where wages and tips are going. I know there's a restaurant in Coal Valley, for example, called Zazi, that has service worked into the bill.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of other restaurants in San Francisco that are starting to do that, turning away from the tipping model entirely and basically like standardizing so that they can guarantee their workers are going to make a set amount.
Mm-hmm.
And I think solutions like that seem more feasible to me.
Well, there was a time when San Francisco put in Healthy San Francisco in order for service workers to get better health care. And a lot, you know, suddenly that fee was found on people's receipts. And it was very clear. It's like, this is to help cover Healthy San Francisco. Is that fair to pass that cost along to the consumer, or is that something the business should be taking up? Jesse, I'll start with you.
I mean, so generally speaking, this concept of fairness in jobs gets complex, but most other jobs, you do get things like basic health insurance that go with the job. And the idea that you have to pull this out and put it on the bill with a specific label, as opposed to just have it be regulated into one of the things that the back of the house has to offer you mm-hmm. as a waiter, you know, or something like that. And so I'd say in this domain, you know, I would probably, you know, think that the regulation, like with a lot of things in San Francisco, a lot of things in California, there's regulation that sounds great and makes us feel good, and then we put it in place and it's awful and expensive.
Yeah.
Right. And a lot of these costs at restaurants are these crazy additional things where, oh, this sounds like a great idea. We passed some law back in 1994 and mm-hmm. now we're living with it. And it's yeah. $25,000 on the install and XYZ, blah, blah,
yeah,
blah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And now you're paying $35 for an entree.
Yeah, well, it's not cheap. We're discussing tipping here at State of the Bay on Local Public Radio 91.7. I'm Grace Wan. I have in the studio with me Jesse Antilla Hughes. He's an economics professor at University of San Francisco, and also Sarah Holtz, a food and culture writer for the San Francisco Standard. And listeners, what do you think constitutes a good tip? Have you been asked to tip in a situation that you were surprised about? And business owners who have employees that are tipped, how do you handle that? Would you prefer offering a flat fee? Join us by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Or find us on Twitter. We're at State of Bay. We have an email from a listener. Sam writes, did kitchen workers and bus boys, girls, women formerly get tipped? It kind of makes sense to tip them, but I used to think of tipping as only being about the servers. What do you think, Sarah?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not entirely sure when bus people ended up getting factored into tipping. I think it really varies, and I don't think there's like one set standard, but it's my understanding that tips have even either been pooled or workers who are directly serving tables are the ones who get tipped.
And we have another question here from, sorry about that, from a tweet from Penny. Are you taking out the cost of inflation on servers? Here are some words to live by. If you can afford the food at inflation prices, then you can afford to inflate the tip. What do you say to that, Jesse?
I would say that one gets filed under the moral actions by us individually are nice for us individually, but that's not going to put bread on my table if I'm actually a hungry guy working. In the sense that, you know, with inflation, all these prices are rising, and the question of how much the tip as a norm should be set is its own kind of moral tension type thing. And this is both us when we're feeling flush in San Francisco going out, but also us when we go out to a normal restaurant in the normal neighborhood when we're also ourselves perhaps like a waiter going to another restaurant, and really the extra little bit of cost matters. So I'd say that, you know, inflation is going to make everything rise, including your wage, hopefully, at the end of the day. But whether or not people are getting a living wage is its own moral question. And
yeah.
I mean, that's if we shouldn't be using tips to try to close that gap.
Right. We have an email from Sean. He writes, as a bartender living in San Francisco, I would just like to mention that for my entire adult life, the $1 per drink tipping standard has been in play. But as time progresses and inflation drives prices and the cost of living further up, this paradigm fails to hold up. When I make and serve, say, four $15 martinis amounting to a $60 bill, a $4 tip feels somewhat insulting and lacking, especially considering that my base pay is minimum wage and I also am encumbered with the high cost of living in San Francisco. The bottom line is that if service industry people are not compensated fairly, they simply can't exist here, and there will be nobody available to serve those tasty martinis. Until such time as wages are hiked dramatically, we rely existentially unnecessarily generous tips. I mean, Sean, I want you to know that Sarah and Jesse are vigorously nodding their heads in agreement here in the studio with you. I mean, what's your reaction to Sean's email, Sarah?
Yeah, I think Sean is absolutely right. I think, you know, it's what we've been saying. Tipping has become this sort of emotional decision. And then it's also there's this sense that like, oh, this is the rule. You tip 15%, or you tip 20%, or you tip $1 for a beer. Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, I don't know, maybe Jesse would agree, like, that's not very dialectical, like, in terms of economics. And also, like, yeah, things change. There's supply chain shortages.
Mm-hmm.
Cost of food has gone up.
Mm-hmm.
Rent is very, very costly in San Francisco. And so it seems like those rules are just completely outdated at this point.
Yeah, and I think Sean makes a really interesting point that if we want people to work in these industries and have these jobs, if we care about going to a restaurant and getting served by someone who lives in the Bay Area, then we need to think about what they're being paid. Okay, Jesse, I know you've been like nodding your head vigorously, and I want you to come in here.
Yeah, Sean, thank you so much for bringing up the $1 pegging of tips. That actually, I think if we're thinking about inflation, that's something that should be inflated. Because the marginal value of a dollar has been going down. And that exact thing, the $1 for a beer,
right,
was fine in 1995,
yeah,
right, or 2000. But now that it's 2023,
yeah,
I mean, like, I my heart goes out to anyone who's making $15 cocktails and getting tipped $1. I think the general norm should be dollar per drink or 15 to 20%, whichever is more.
And
if someone's taking, this is part of what's crazy about that high-end cocktail movement is it's a ton of labor for each one of these drinks.
Yeah.
And then if people don't reciprocate with the norm, they're paying $18 for the drink and then giving the bartender like a dollar, and it's like, come on, this is a high craft thing. Like,
yeah,
what are you doing?
Well, I just did the math. It'd be $12 tip for on 20% on 60, you know. So Sean, we hope you get paid more,
yeah,
for your drinks, and write in and tell us where you work, and then we'll put a shout out to that as well. There is something called dark patterns that impact our behavior in terms of tipping. I think that you know, that's this technology that's kind of built into, we were talking about these POS, these point of sale service things that kind of force us to tip. But should it even be more? I mean, there's a no tip section. You can barely find it. I think they mostly stop at 25%. But Sarah, should they be higher?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, at this point, in a city like San Francisco, with where we're at, with housing and with inflation, everything else, Potentially. I maybe am afraid when I think about if it wasn't like a 20, 25%, 30% choice, if people were able to just fill in the blank.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it leaves it up to the customer who may be having a bad day,
yeah,
or may just be reacting to some perceived slight. And mm-hmm. I think that's a little dangerous for restaurant workers.
Mm-hmm. A question for Maureen, and I'm going to leave this to you, Sarah. Some restaurant tabs include tax, health fees, etc. Are you expected to tip on the total or just on the food and drink?
I found that restaurants usually make it clear if they're factoring in healthcare and things like that. Again, if it were me, if I have the choice to tip on top of that, I do.
Mm-hmm.
But that's usually, it's clear whether you have a choice or not.
Mm-hmm.
Often restaurants will work everything in and you just sign for the total.
Yeah. And sometimes the receipt even includes it tells you exactly what 18, 20, 25% of a tip would be on that. I once, I had a friend who, little tipsy, she couldn't figure out the tip. So where the tip line was, she just wrote math and then she put down a total, what she was willing to pay for the meal, which I thought was quite funny. Jesse, what do you think about tipping on the total? Like, what should you be tipping on?
Well, I mean, so again, this is one of these moral types of questions. And I think one of the big things we get out of a lot of econ when you push up against it is that pulling the politics out of econ and vice versa often doesn't work. And this is very much one of these things. Like, what should we do? And so I think for this, again, when we say 15 or 20%, or that's typically off of the pre-tax food, et cetera, total. And then mm-hmm. everybody is using that as a common base. You know, you double the tax, get the tip, for example, which is
right.
The classic way of doing it in New York. From there, like what we should do, I again think that this is an example where the thing we should focus on is making sure that someone back of the house, front of the house, like runner, mm-hmm. bartender, whatever it is like earning a good living wage mm-hmm. regardless. And in particular, you know, as we nudge these things up, you mentioned dark patterns before. One of the things we know about these types of nudges, whether it's policy side, whether it's corporate side, is that they can really blow up in your face. Like if people start thinking, oh, they're offering me the option of a 30% tip or a 35% tip, then how about no tip?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And so that kind of, that's part of why these things with these sorts of cultural norms require mm-hmm. this cooperative set of things. So people can say, okay, this is the 15 to 20% tip, but I'm personally fine with the wage that I'm getting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm
mm-hmm.
I'm not out here like really like dying without the tips.
Yeah.
You know,
have you ever been asked to give a tip in an industry where you're somewhat surprised, maybe not taken aback, but just thought, oh, I never thought of tipping in this context. Has that ever hit you, Jesse?
I'd have to think for a little bit. Certainly, especially international travel and certain types of random institutional interactions.
Right? Uh-huh.
Like there's a classic role in New York City, and a New York City that is mostly gone now called the fixer,
uh-huh.
which is like the person that deals with legal interaction stuff. Like, oh, I need a document signed. I need to pay my taxes.
Yeah.
Like, I'm a recent immigrant. I don't speak English.
Yeah.
You know, I need someone who can interface with the incident. And so I think a lot of those types of roles, you often find some degree mm-hmm. of tipping in. And
mm-hmm.
in similar fashion, I think it kind of gets back to that, when can tipping be good, right?
Yeah.
As both a sort of a guarantee of quality and also sometimes just as an expression of thanks and quality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think sometimes the tips that you'll sometimes see happen will be like, you know, someone does an absolutely amazing job when they don't have to because they just cared.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, oh, I'll tip this person. Like, you know, she went above and beyond
right.
to make sure this was actually done right when really didn't have to, you know.
Yeah, you gotta love that. Well, we're gonna have to leave it there. We've sadly run out of time, but we could talk about this forever, I think. And I hope you guys will come back up at some point. I want to thank you both for joining us. It was such an interesting conversation. We've been talking about tipping, and I've been joined by Sarah Holtz, the food and culture writer for the San Francisco Standard. Thanks again, Sarah.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we're also here with Jesse Antilla Hughes. He's an economics professor at the University of San Francisco. Thanks for elucidating us, Jesse.
Please. Thanks so much for having me. It was great.
Great. And coming up next on State of the Bay, we're going to hear about the violinist Raginder, who's being interviewed by my co-host Ethan Elkind. Stay with us.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. This is Ethan Elkind. You've just heard Almost, a new track from the violinist, songwriter, and producer Raginder and his longtime collaborator, Pakistani-Canadian musician Convict. Raginder moved to Hayward from Thailand when he was 8 years old and started playing the violin at an early age. Inspired by both his South Asian roots and his upbringing in the East Bay, Raginder is known for his fusion of Indian classical music with hip-hop and R&B. While his early performances were predominantly at South Asian weddings, his audience has grown in the last 12 years, and his second album, Letters from the Other Side, was released last year, prompting a 5-city North American music tour. His song Summer Nights, a collaboration with the artist Wisechild, was also featured on the Disney Plus hit show Ms. Marvel. You can even find Raginder in Vogue's 8 South Asian Creatives Who Had an Eye-Opening 2022. So, Raginder, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you for having me. I'm so glad to be here.
So you were born in Bangkok, grew up in the East Bay. Tell us what your childhood was like.
I grew up in a country full of, you know, people that don't look like me. But there's also a very large South Asian population in Bangkok. And so I kind of grew with this Thai culture and South Asian culture. And they really like American pop music out there. So I grew up listening to a lot of Prince, Michael Jackson out there. So I was very familiar with American pop culture. And so once I moved here, you know, it was very much the same melting pot, but it was different in a sense that a lot of people didn't listen to Michael Jackson at that time. You know, I was like, oh, what about Prince? What about Michael Jackson? At least people my age. And they were very much like, oh, no, we listen to hip hop. We listen to R&B. We listen to this. So it was very much different in a musical term, but it was already something I was used to living in a country that wasn't ethnically my own. So I initially came towards a very tumultuous time a month before 9/11. So there were some growing pains, but eventually we got over it. And now it's a very vibrant community that I'm very glad to be a part of.
Yeah. Well, so with all that diversity around you and with your background, how did that influence your music?
So I think the first biggest thing that influenced my music was my parents. So my parents are musicians themselves, and they made sure that I was in an environment that had a lot of music throughout the day. And then eventually, once I moved to America, I felt like I was living two different lives, where my parents were exposing me to South Asian music, to spiritual Indian music. And at school, I was predominantly just listening to hip-hop, R&B, pop. And so I felt like I was living these two different lives, and I was interacting in more traditional terms at home. And at school, I was like, you know, picking up the Bay Area slang and all these different things. And, you know, you're around so much diversity that you learn how to count in Spanish and speak some things in Spanish or Tagalog. And there's like so many different things at school. And so eventually I got to a point where I was like, how can I bridge these worlds together? And in high school is when I first started doing that.
And so what inspired you to start playing and then composing music?
I think it was very much expected of me in a sense, because I was in a musical family, and it was very much like, all right, this is what we do. This is multi-generational. But in the beginning, it wasn't about doing it professionally. It was very much like, we want this to be a big part of your life. So I started composing, like I was saying earlier, was in high school. And my friends that listened to me play violin, they didn't really understand the South Asian classical music too much, because it's a very deep spiritual art form. And, you know, it takes some researching and deep diving into, like, just kind of understanding what the music is, because it's a little slower and it's very introspective. So they're like, you know, you play well, but we don't understand what you're playing. So I was like, all right, let me bridge these two worlds together. So I took a hip hop beat at that time, and it was this artist from the Bay Area. His name was Clyde Carson. So he had the song called Doing That back in the day. And so I took the instrumental and I recorded some violin over it, and I just put it on my MySpace. And, you know, it started getting shared around the school. And that's kind of like my first introduction to composing.
What is it that appealed to you about the violin?
Initially, there was no appeal. Initially, I actually wanted to play the trumpet. And, you know, the violin was a second choice. It was just like, all right, cool. Like, it's cool. I don't know what in me wanted to be a trumpet player, but I went home and I was like, hey, guys, I want to play the trumpet. I think my parents just didn't want to hear a loud horn instrument in the house. And they're like, what else do you want to play? So I was like, violin. They're like, all right, try that out. And it came to me naturally.
And we mentioned earlier Summer Nights, or collaboration with Wisechild, which we're going to hear later. That's on the Disney Plus show Ms. Marvel. Can you tell us a little bit about that series and how you became involved in it?
Yes, yes. I actually was in LA at that time, and or I just opened up my DMs on Instagram, and I see someone being like, hey, we really love your music. Would you be interested in collaborating for the Ms. Marvel series? And I saw this DM and I'm like, is this real? Like, you know, like this multi-billion dollar industry just like hitting me up on Instagram DM. So what they wanted to do was have me on the original soundtrack. So once they hired me and I was just sending them tracks back to back to back. And then they're like, oh, by the way, we're using your track for the episode. And I was really excited, but I had no idea that they would use it on the Marvel intro when, you know, you saw all the superheroes and it says Marvel. And so that was really surreal, because I think seeing Marvel movies is such a part of like the American experience, and to just hear your track in the back of like that intro was just so surreal. I had goosebumps while watching it. So
yeah,
that's how it came about. And I'm still very, very grateful for that opportunity.
Yeah, must have been a thrill and a good reminder to check your DMs. So you recently crossed the border on foot, the border between India and Pakistan. Can you describe what that experience was like and why you were there?
Yes. So I was in India to just network, record, and, you know, just have a good time, connect with my roots. Because I make music that's for the West and for India, it just makes sense to be there as well. The way India's history is, it's very interesting. You know, like India was basically a subcontinent. It was never a country. But the British came in, was like, all right, we're going to make this a country, and then we're going to divide it amongst religious lines. So, you know, my family comes from the state of Punjab. And so I flew over to Punjab my last couple of days of the trip. And I was like, you know, instead of taking a flight, I'm actually going to cross the border. There's no direct flights between India and Pakistan because there's a lot of tension between the countries. And so you have to fly to Dubai and then go into Karachi or Lahore from there, which is just an extra 7-8 hour journey. So I decided to do the thing on foot, and it was very surreal because things were divided amongst religious lines, and especially in the state of Punjab, there's Punjab in the Indian side and there's Punjab in the Pakistan side. And, you know, religiously, you know, we're different. Like in the India side, it's more Hindus and Sikhs. And in Pakistan, it's obviously Muslims, but we speak the same language. We eat the same food. We have the same culture. So it was very surreal to just kind of cross on foot and then go on the other side, and they're still speaking to you in the same language. If anything, they were even kinder. They were like, oh, welcome to your ancestral land. This is where, you know, you guys belong. So it was just very surreal to cross this really tense border and then come to the other side, and you're greeted with such great hospitality, such great kindness. And it goes to show that there's a lot more that unites us as people than divides us. And I feel like if we can just kind of accept that fact and really apply it in our everyday lives, the world can be a much better place.
Absolutely. Very well said. And it sounds like a really eye-opening experience. So just going back to your music, what are you working on now? And are there any upcoming live performances that you'd want to highlight for our listeners?
So right now, you know, music's basically a way of life at this point. So every month I'm like trying to release a track. So this year I've released 3 tracks so far, one being Almost, I played earlier. We live in a time where people's attention spans are short, so we just have to constantly churn out material. As far as performances, you know, at the moment I'm taking a break from tour, but I'm doing one-off performances here and there. So I think if you just keep up with me on socials, you'll kind of see my schedule. But there is a fall tour plan this year. And once that comes around, I'll be hopefully in more cities across North America and even in Europe. So that's the plan.
Great. Well, we'll make sure we have links to your social media on our website. And Raginder, best of luck to you. Thank you so much for coming on State of the Bay and sharing your story and your music with us.
Thank you, Ethan. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. We want to thank all of our guests and listeners for joining us and being part of the conversation. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page on KALW.org. If you have questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, let us know. Email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org and definitely call in for that cool t-shirt. Make a donation today, 1-800-525-9917 or kalw.org. Just click donate. Tonight's show was produced by Katie Colley, Kendra Klang, and Wendy Holcomb. It was engineered by David Kwan, and D Minor was our board operator. I'm Grace Wan. Good night, and thanks for listening. Up next is an encore presentation of Your Calls, One Planet series. Have a great night.